Hello, welcome to Literally from the North Shore, and thanks for tuning in. Today we are listening to Sins of Our Fathers, a novel by Sean Lawrence Otto, published in 2014 by Milkweed Editions. The audiobook version is broadcast with permission from Blackstone Audio.
Frank Jorgensen, who at 33 had recently been promoted to president, noticed the influx of femininity and took a liking to J.W. He'd come over and goof around with him when the girls were in. J.W. soon realized this was a performance of sorts, but he enjoyed it too, and Frank was funny in a pudgy, self-deprecating sort of way. One day he even asked one of the girls out on a date. When her parents came into the bank to talk to him about it, he told them he had been joking. They couldn't be serious. I mean, look at me. And soon he had them laughing about the whole misunderstanding, while their daughter sat red-faced in the reception area. Other times he would run for a six-pack of Grain Belt, J.W. was still 17, and they would sit in Frank's office after hours and drink, while Frank lectured to him about banking and how the world was changing. There are too many people. There are going to be fights over resources, Frank said. He pointed his beer bottle at J.W., his eyes glistening. We bankers are in a position to control that, and it's going to make us immensely rich. J.W. kicked himself again for not staying for a beer with Jorgensen. The road dipped into another low vale that blocked the sun. The air flowed down cool and moist with a gathering fog, smelling richly of fresh-cut alfalfa. On the left, the land rose to a hayfield that still looked dry and warm in the long sun. A farmer drove a red tractor over the short-cropped stems, pulling a dusty green hay baler and a fully stacked wagon. Two boys sat high atop the bales, pitching and rolling. He felt the congestion of the city falling away. He tuned the radio to the Power Loon, and soon he was singing along to an oldie about satisfaction, hey. 10 minutes later, he pulled into a Senex station and got out under the yellow-white canopy. The red band on the pumps glowed in the beautifying light of what his high school photography teacher, a peripatetic man named Rolf Van Heuvel, who wore a walrus mustache and clogs, had called the magic hour. He passed the pumps and went inside. It had become somewhat of a tradition, buying artificial flowers at this Senex. They sold bouquets of them in a plastic bucket near the register, pale blues and reds and yellows and whites, all mixed together in a pop music arrangement of pastel fireworks. He set the bundle on the seat of his car and pulled back out into the sunset. Driving home reminded him of happier times, when he had driven the same road with Julie. On her birthdays he would take her out of school, and they went on elaborate field trips to the Science Museum in St. Paul, or the aquarium in Duluth, or the Cirrus aircraft plant. These were natural interests of hers that her mother didn't respond to, but he believed you took a kid's natural interests and built the kid up into the world from there. The interest was the foundation. So he gave her options, and they would go on the field trip she was most excited about. They called these trips their dates, and they would talk about nature and science and biology. J.W. even made a point of studying up on these subjects so he could answer her questions. He bought her books. He started a subscription to Scientific American. It was different with his son, Chris. First, it had been stamp collecting. The two of them had spent hours bent over the yellow kitchen table with duck-billed tweezers, surrounded by wax paper, and fat, staticky books reeking of mastic, stamps flapping like gossamer insect wings as they turned the heavy pages. But the stamps' filigree soon faded into the hormone bath of early adolescence, and then it was all power and gas. Mini-bikes and small engines led to the homemade go-kart with the old Kohler he had salvaged from a broken wood splitter. Then it was on to hunting and gun safety classes, an interest that was abandoned, in turn, after Chris squatted next to the doe he shot at 13, looking into its dark eye, petting its fur as its organs steamed in an iridescent pile among the leaves and forest detritus. After that, it was back to engines, first tuning the riding mower to achieve peak performance, and eventually the Mustang they had bought for just $700. They spent long nights bent over it in the garage while J.W.'s car sat outside in the weather, their hands coated with a gritty molasses of black oil and road dust, their knuckles skinned red in the engine's dark cubbies. What he wouldn't give to have just one of those long, sore nights back. The air grew dusty and dry now, despite the cooling. The purple-orange sky had faded to sapphire, and billboard lights flickered on. He was nearing the big prairie, where the rolling hills and dales of the glacial moraine began to flatten and stretch their legs westward for their run through the Dakotas. Here the billboards were smaller, made by locals from plywood on 6x6 posts. They hunkered close to the road, lit from below by fluorescent tubes that attracted fleets of dive-bombing insects. Spiders cast their nets into the night seas and sailed out on bands of silk. He passed a sign for the Many Lakes Casino. Work hard, play hard, win big. He was nearing home. As J.W. drove, he watched closely for the roadside spot where it had happened. It was easy to miss, in spite of the fact that it held such life-changing prominence. Sometimes he had to turn around and go hunting for it, peering across the pavement as he drove, searching for the small white cross. But this time he saw it early, backlit by the low-angled sun, and he pulled over and got out. He walked around the car, took the bouquet out of the passenger door, and carried it over to the marker, which bore a single word, Chris. An older bundle of flowers was faded by the sun and covered with a patina of dust kicked up by a month of car traffic. He squatted and untwisted the wire that he used to hold them in place, then fastened the new bouquet and arranged it as fully and attractively as possible, fluffing the individual petals to broaden the flower heads. "Good night, son," he said. He stood and carried the old bouquet to the car, throwing it into the passenger footwell, where it couldn't sully the upholstery. The dusky rolling hills ran out behind him under darkening skies, and the wind filled his ears as he drove on. Ahead, the road climbed back out of the valley, and the dark planes of a building materialized from the shadows on the right. The fading light conjured parts of cars, and then 14 massive searchlights shot up into the sky, their beams crossing to form a giant teepee of white light. Banks of neon splashed out, the colors bouncing over the roofs and glass parts of the cars like thrown watercolors. "Many Lakes Casino," the roadside monument said. "Win big." He passed the turnoff, the neon glow lighting his windshield and turning the backs of his hands red on the wheel. He thought of Chris's accident and the sudden shock of it, a ripping away when he hadn't been looking. The red fell from his hands like fading fingers as he climbed the hill, a new vista opening, and his thoughts returned to the dinner Carol had waiting, where he hoped to save his marriage and his relationship with Julie, his remaining child. Chris's death had sent him into a tailspin, futility crashing over him in swamping waves, spinning him in the undertow. Problems had cropped up in their marriage, cracks and fissures that grew into crevasses and canyons, over money, over his gambling. Carol always seemed angry, and Julie had stopped talking to him. But Carol had agreed to see him, and his heart sped a little now that the moment was imminent. He adjusted his visor against the low blast of sun. He was going to find a way, starting tonight, to turn things around. A way to come together and move forward again. Not as if nothing had happened, but acknowledging that it had, and then finding the forgiveness and the strength and the love to heal together. He didn't really know what he was going to say, but he was determined to make it happen. His caprice shot on into the sunset, becoming small and bright as a satellite. But even then he could feel gravity taking hold. The waves of the casino accreted weight and moment. The car reached a sort of apogee, and then he pulled over and turned around. Chapter 3. The Many Lakes Casino lot was awash in color and buzzing with sound. A charter bus disgorged senior citizens under the massive front portico, their silver hair running from green to red to blue in the shifting lights. One of them trailed an oxygen tank with aluminum wheels. J.W. turned off his car. A breeze lifted in through the window. The dark leaves of sugar beet greens clattered on the edge of the lot. Several pairs of men and women were walking toward the casino, hand in hand. Julie had given J.W. a plastic Jesus on the cross when she was 9 or 10, and it dangled from his rearview mirror, swaying in the breeze, its clear plastic beads refracting the colored lights. He reached up and steadied it. He needed to get home, but the day had unsettled him. "Okay," he said, closing his eyes. "If I open my eyes and see a man and a woman holding hands, I'll go in. Just for 5 minutes. Just send me a sign." Carol would have dinner in the oven by now. It would be out in half an hour. He needed to patch things up with her and Julie, to heal the rifts that had formed since the accident. He hadn't handled it well. He knew that. She had been even more distant lately, not returning his calls, and the red heat of anger that had been in her voice this last year was fading into a cool reserve. It was fine. He could do what he wanted, whatever he thought was best. All phrases to let him know that life and Carol were moving on, that they had become unhitched. If she would only wait, if he could just get through this, come out the other end with the big win, it would get better. Because with money came hope and freedom. He could tell Carol about Frank wanting to have a beer, how it made him late and he'd been driving fast to make up the time. Just a half hour inside the casino. Just a short bump. It would give him time to bolster himself. He opened his eyes, but no one was holding hands. He craned his neck to peer around the rear window stanchion. Not a single couple. He laughed and shook his head. All right, I hear you," he said. He reached for his dangling keys, but then he saw two women join hands. Close enough. He got out and locked the car. Just in and out. 5 minutes. 10 tops. A quick bang. It always improved his mood, energized him, made things somehow more manageable. He shot his cuffs and headed for the grand portico. Most people would be crazy to go gambling like he did, he knew, but as a finance professional, he had an advantage, and he used it. He understood margins and risk in a way casual gamblers did not. The senior citizens were clogging the entry foyer. They chattered and lurched about, trying to buy chips. He maneuvered his way through the irritable throng. A voice that sounded like Willie Nelson wafted out of the theater, singing, "You Are My Sunshine." He had sung that to Julie as a baby. He stepped into the enswathing maternal smell of stale cigarette smoke. He spent $300 on chips and headed into a sonic cloud of silvery coin chinking. No wonder old people like casinos, he thought. He didn't care for the slots himself because there was no skill involved. He sometimes played poker, but most nights his game was blackjack. And tonight, something was going to happen. He could feel it. He was a dog on the hunt, yelping and straining at the leash, shedding his stiff banking persona, and thrilled to be giving himself up to chance. He passed Charlie and Maynard, two native guards. "Mr. White?" Maynard nodded. "Maynard? Charlie?" he replied. A native waitress named Stormy carried a tray of drinks. Wide, high cheeks, a flat nose, small eyes with a laugh in them, big hoop earrings. They said she was Dakota, but she'd been living outside North Lake and working at the casino for years. She always seemed to find him. "Good evening, Mr. White," she said. "Stormy, it is a great evening. You time me. I'll be in and out in 5 minutes. Boom. $1,000. Or 10. She laughed as he lifted a drink from her tray, feeling spry. She shook her head and walked on. The chrome and green glass escalator gleamed with the satisfying quality of 1950s science fiction, smooth as ice to the touch. It had seemed such a ridiculous thing the first time he saw it, going up a single floor, short in stature and full of grandeur, like the prized possession of a pygmy chieftain. But it had grown on him, his stairway to heaven. He stepped off and rounded the corner by the Moose Cafe bar, heading for the blackjack section, where the smiling dealers waited behind their Kool-Aid blue half-moon tables, always welcoming, always encouraging, but somewhat otherworldly. "Welcome back, Mr. White." They greeted him like a head of state. "Welcome back." The tables seemed somehow alive, their felt almost like a skin, warm and cool at once, and printed with zones to show where the cards went. The edges were padded for comfort, and each table had four inviting chairs. The dealers stood inside the moon's curves, ready to play. J.W. picked his luckiest table and sat down. Gambling, like banking, was all about managing risk. J.W. kept a tattered book on blackjack in the car. He had read it cover to cover many times, seeking clues to bend the arc of fate his way. The biggest thing to overcome was the house advantage, which came from being able to play more than one player at a time, tilting the odds slightly in the dealer's favor. Teams of players secretly working together could overcome this by playing at different tables, but the casinos banned anyone caught doing it. An individual could overcome it by counting cards, mentally adding one every time a small card was played, and subtracting one every time an ace or 10 card came up. When the count got high, it meant the deck was loaded with tens, and you went in big. But there were cameras over every table, trained on the players to watch for this sort of too-convenient timing, so J.W. was cautious about using this method. Still, there was something about trolling the stormy ocean of chance and pulling a big win back out of it that drew his obsessions to the surface. Tonight, as it turned out, he didn't need to count. The cards were all going his way naturally. The payout in blackjack is 3-2, and on splits and double downs a player can double that. The goal is to hit 21 without going over. The dealer stays on 17 or above. J.W.'s luck held, and over the course of an hour he kept getting the cards, one after another. His $300 multiplied until he had 27,000 in stacks of multicolored chips. A crowd gathered, young, vibrant, alive in the moment, enjoying his spectacular winning streak. The table felt glowed electric blue, and the cards had a satisfying, slippery thwack. He knew people tended to make mistakes under such pressure. The best thing you could do was to follow a system and forget about the money and the audience. Some players pulled 10, 20, or even 50% back out of each hand as a policy decision, but in his mind, this was foolish, because over time the house had a slight statistical advantage. By holding back, he would not be fully putting his money to work against that advantage. Mathematically, it was better to have all his chips in play, and to play it up as fast as he could, then get out. That's what he was about to do after another hand. It was time. He could feel it. But he was within spitting distance of paying off the second mortgage on his house. He felt in total control, reacting instantly. He saw the move, he felt it, he knew it was right, and he played it, over and over. Bam, 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 Thor at the hammer, directing each slam of lightning, there, there, there. But that was a false sense. He knew it. He reminded himself to stay calm. He didn't have to hit 21. He didn't even have to beat the other players. An old man in a rumpled suit, his ashen face was caving in on itself, presented no competition. Neither did a younger one with earrings and a goatee and the cocky puppy dog air of some sort of media artist. He slouched in his paisley shirt and flung his dark, greasy forelock aside, then let it fall again before flinging it back as if it had only just fallen for the first time. J.W. only had to beat the dealer. Bam! Another win! Yes! The old man pushed back from the table with a wave and a grim expression. J.W. watched him hobble off through the surrounding crowd. He took a sip from his drink and cautioned himself to use math, not to get sucked in by his emotions as the stakes rose. If he could stay technical, he could maximize his chances of finding a streak that would beat the house advantage in an even bigger way. He refocused on the game as the dealer began another round. He had cleared nearly every ace in the shoe. He'd counted 7 of them. Aces give players a lot of protection because they can be played as a 1 or as an 11. So if you bust past 21 playing the ace high, you can fall back and use it as a 1. Now that there was only one other player at the table, the odds were actually starting to tilt further in his favor. "Hit me," he was about to say, but he held up to think it through, and Goatee looked over at him, mildly amused, and took a slug of his cocktail. "You doing okay, my man?" J.W. nodded, giving him minimal attention. It was stupid to banter at a time like this. It was all about managing risk. He was at 17, and this was not the conservative move he'd been making all night long. His heart sped up just thinking about it. But he'd seen almost every face card played already, and the 10s too, so the chances of going bust were smaller than average. In fact, they were increasingly smaller than average. Still, it was crazy to take a chance with so much money riding on one bet, so this time he held back 3,000 in chips, breaking his own policy. The crowd applauded as if he'd done something brilliant. A man came out of nowhere and pointed at him. "You, sir, are a winner." Obviously drunk. He sipped the water from the bottom of his ice. Stormy swooped in with another round of free drinks. "No, I'm okay," said Goatee. He lifted his hands up and leaned back, patting his paisley belly. "I gotta maintain my girlish figure." He laughed and flung his hair. "Gotta fit in a canoe tomorrow."
"J.W., why don't you take a break?" whispered Stormy.
He could feel her warm breath on his cheek as she clawed up his old cocktail napkin.
"Have a drink and cool down," she said.
He glanced at her and saw her concern. Dave Anderson, the casino manager, was watching from behind the crowd. He had read that managers often sent a waitress like Stormy in to distract a player and break a winning streak. "We need this," he told her. He thought about the relief, how happy Carol would be. "Hit me," he told the dealer. It was a 3. His instincts were verified, and the crowd applauded. He had an extremely formidable 20. Stormy sighed and pulled away with her tray.
"I'll stay," he laughed.
3-2 on 24 grand. He'd hit the road with $39,000, enough to really turn things around. Goatee busted out at 24.
"Dude, it's all yours," he conceded, pushing back from his chair, smiling around at the onlookers, his cheeks bright red.
J.W. nodded and waved. Everything he had was riding on the next few cards. He should be nervous, he realized, but he felt good, confident. The math was on his side. The probability of the dealer beating his 20 was very low. He was giddy. He was bouncing his knee under the table.
"Dealer has an ace in the hole. Does the player want to buy insurance?"
It had to be the last ace. And even though he was a finance guy, J.W. hated insurance. He preferred to use risk management strategies that he could control. He quickly ran through the odds. If the dealer turned up an ace, chances were about 1 in 3 that the next card would be a 10 card and the dealer would hit 21. An insurance bet was like hedging in stocks. It paid 2 to 1 if the dealer got 21, helping mitigate the loss. But you lost it if not, which dampened the win. He drummed his fingers. Because so many face cards had already been played, the chances of the dealer turning up a 10 were lower than normal, and 21 was the only score that could beat his hand. Plus, he only had 3,000 held out of play to bet with, so even if he won the insurance bet, he'd walk away with a measly 6,000, and if he won the main bet, he'd lose the 3, reducing his take to 36,000, which was short of the amount he had decided he would walk away at. He could take a loan from the casino, but he didn't really have any more money in the bank to pay it back with.
"I'll pass. Just one card more." The dealer's king of hearts. The blast of it obliterated all other sound. Gone were the incessant chinking and bleeping, the congratulatory encouragements of the slot machines. Gone were the music and the cacophonous crowd applauding his moves. Gone were the sibilant laughter of his children and the raspy guffaws of his wife. Gone were the discussions, the awards, the handshakes at the bank. The only sound in life was the sound of a car crashing and thundering through his chest.
"House wins," he faintly heard the dealer say.
He closed his eyes. It was gone. He struggled for logic. "Don't try to recapture it," he thought. "Just realize where you are now." And yet a wall of grief rose up in him. All that money, just torn away. He opened his eyes and looked down at his remaining chips. A measly 3 grand. The crowd of poor, older people began to drift away. It shouldn't have been. The odds had been with him. But he had to play on and put emotion behind him.
You have been listening to Episode 3 of Sins of Our Fathers by Sean Lawrence Otto. The novel will be presented in a total of 23 episodes. If you miss any, you can catch up on our website, ktwh.org. Choose Programs and then Literally from the North Shore from the drop-down list. Please join us again next time for Episode 4 of Sins of Our Fathers here on Literally from the North Shore.